Hello.
Mother.
Hello. There's a lot of cracking and banging going on.
there's cracking, really?
Well, it was when you picked it up.
It's not cracking. Crackling. Not cracking now, though, right?
No, it's not.
No. Okay, good. Yeah, no, I was just setting things up. I'm just testing the microphone. I'm here in Texas, and I'm setting up the microphone for the show today because I'm going to be interviewing.
Oh, good.
I'm going to be interviewing Brad Garrett.
Oh, that's cool.
From Everybody Loves Raymond.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let me ask you this: How do you think I did on Joe Rogan's podcast this week?
I think you did very well for 2/3 of it, and then maybe a third you might have cut back on the shot, but that was okay.
So you think, but was it funny when I drank the whiskey?
Yeah, I mean, you didn't say anything bad or anything. It was just, you know, took you a little bit longer to think of an answer to any question that you might have been given.
Yeah. Yeah, because I know I don't, you
thought
know, I
processing slows.
I don't normally drink that much on Joe Rogan's amazing podcast. We did drink some whiskey the last time, but I don't know, just because I'm on the road and I've been traveling.
What's the first time you'd seen anybody?
Yeah, I haven't seen anyone for a while, and you know, Joe's my friend, and he had some good whiskey, and next thing you know, the conversation started flowing a little more
freely. Unfreely.
Yeah. But I mean, I didn't say anything dumb, did I?
No.
You and Dad watched the whole thing, right?
We watched the whole thing, yes.
How long was
we
it?
We did.
5 hours?
Close to.
Yeah.
I didn't exactly, you know, but
because,
pretty close to.
Because
4 hours and something.
Yeah, 4 hours and something. Because I figured, you know, the first part of the interview, Joe talked to me about the van and all the traveling I'm doing, and that was awesome. And then I talked to him a bit about what he's been doing with his move to Austin. And then I just kind of thought, hey, you know, we should have a drink because we sometimes will have a drink of whiskey. But man, it ended up.
It went downhill from there.
that's what I'm asking. Did it or no?
No, I'm just teasing you, Tom.
So it was fun, right?
Yeah, it looks like you were having a fun time.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Because I got to admit, like, the end of the show got a little foggy to me.
I'm not surprised.
Like, when I keep hearing about things that I did on the show that I sort of didn't remember until I was reminded.
Sort of, kind of remember?
Well, like, I guess, did I do push-ups at the end, or...
Yes, you did push up.
Yeah, so I kind of remember doing that, but anyways, it was a good time. I'm getting a lot of great feedback about it, and everybody, of course, loves the Joe Rogan podcast. And
No kidding.
This was a real experience, the Joe Rogan experience. I experienced it in many ways this time. But it was great. Good. Well, thanks for listening, and thanks for helping me do my audio check.
No problem. What is your podcast called? Tom Green.
You don't know what your son's podcast is called?
Well, is it? No, I don't actually.
You don't know.
You
don't know what my podcast is called?
Tom, I'm old. I can't remember all the things that I apparently should.
Well, it's sort of got a new. It's got a new name too. It's called the Tom Green Interview. I also
interview.
Yeah, I was doing the Tom Green podcast, but now I also have this one, which is more of an interview based show.
Right.
It's called the Tom Green Interview. Yeah.
Right. That's cool.
I'm Tom Green, and I interview people, and that's why we called it that.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
And it's with this great company, Audio Up, that's kind of supporting the vision and keeping the trains running on time.
Oh, well, that's good. We always like to have trains on time.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're traveling and we're doing it.
I know. That was really neat, your Instagram on Barstow. That was cool.
Oh, yeah. I went to a ghost town on Instagram and streamed live from there. Wait till you see the video that I shot. I got an incredible video out there that I'm editing after my interview today with Brad Garrett.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for calling, Mom. I'll check in with you in a bit.
Okay.
I'm just going to continue testing out everything here and making sure everything's working. Okay.
Okay. Watch out for javelinas.
Yes. Yes, I will.
Okay.
All right. Say hi to Dad.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Talk soon. Bye.
I will.
Bye-bye. That was Mary Jane Green, and I am somewhere in Texas in my van, converted into a recording studio, and recording another episode of the Tom Green Podcast. And we're going to be talking to Brad Garrett today. This is going to be great. I hope you're following along on social media, on YouTube. The videos that I'm shooting are getting more and more complex. I'm really working on the color and the shots and the editing and the whole vision of it, the whole tone of it, even composing the music for it. And I hope you enjoy it. So go look at some of those films that I'm making. I call them short films on youtube.com/TomGreen. And tell your friends to subscribe to this podcast, The Tom Green Interview. Now, let's talk to the legendary and the incredible Brad Garrett. You know Brad from stand-up comedy, of course, from Everybody Loves Raymond. Hello. And he also has an amazing comedy club in Las Vegas.
Tom!
Hey, Brad. How are you? Nice to talk to you. Thanks for calling.
I'm good. It's my pleasure. It's great to talk to you. How you doing?
I'm doing real good. Believe it or not, I'm living in my van, not down by the river, but I've this is by choice. I've been traveling around the country, and I've built this studio in a van, and I'm just kind of doing it to get out and, you know, do something right now during this crazy year. So I'm in.
I love that.
Yeah,
I want to ride shotgun. Do you have room for a giant Jew to ride shotgun?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, you're a pretty tall guy. I'm not sure. You might not actually fit in this thing. But no, you know, it's cool. I'm 6'4". You're 6'8", right?
Right. Yeah.
So I'm 6'4", and I can sort of sleep in the bed on sort of a diagonal thing. It's interesting, but I've been going to all these national parks and to all sorts of interesting ruins. And yesterday I went to a ghost town in Texas, so it's been pretty cool. And I'm traveling with my dog Charlie. So
nice.
Yes.
What kind of van?
It's a Ram ProMaster, which has been converted. So it's sort of like I look like I'm in a FedEx delivery truck, basically. But if you it's got it's got a little kitchen in it. And,
how long have you been doing this?
Just about 6 weeks now. I've been on the road, and I just got the van. It's fun. I live in Los Angeles, so I still have a home,
right,
and stuff. I'm not permanently in the van, but I'm doing some filmmaking and things. But I really, you know, I appreciate you calling. It's exciting to talk to you. The first, you know, I spoke to your partner Ray Romano as well on one of our first episodes of this podcast as well, so that was pretty cool. And we talked a lot about Everybody Loves Raymond but now
right.
how are you doing with the stand up club now? Is the club in Vegas open with all that's going on?
You know, it's a crazy, Tom. They finally let us open 3 weeks ago, but because of all the COVID protocols and everything, the stage has to be 25 feet from the first row. And when we did that at the original club, we had room for 15 people. So they decided to move us temporarily to this giant ballroom upstairs in the hotel that seats like 550, and we could put 145 people in there. So that was like doing an empty corporate, you know? But it was getting people working again. We were open for 3 weeks, weekends only, and they closed it all down again last night, all the shows all over again because of the numbers. The numbers are just insane. So you're probably safest in a van than anywhere.
Yeah, that's kind of the where the idea came from. But, you know, could you have ever imagined, not just a pandemic, but just the concept of stand-up comedy stopping across the country, across the world?
Yeah, it's, you know, people have wanted me to stop stand-up for years. And so this, I feel it's a conspiracy, Tom. This is what it is to get me to stop with my, you know, I have kind of a hacky act. I'm not known for my material, but like a lot of my stuff is all off the audience. You know, that's, you know, that's how I really do like most of my act. And it's so funny. And I walked out the other night, you know, and they're 25 feet away, and I'm still going like great shirt. You know, no one can even see what I'm talking about. So
did it feel
real adjustment?
It must have felt good though, just to get the club open again and just have some activity there, because Vegas has been hit real hard, hasn't it?
Yeah. It was great to open it all. It's been hit incredibly hard. I mean, that's pretty much a state that feeds off the Strip. And, you know, you see these food lines. I mean, in Vegas, they literally run out of food daily for the people that are really, really up against it. And it's, you know, it's a scary time. You know, I have a 20-year-old, a 22-year-old, and, you know, they're in the middle of school, of college, and everything's online, and they, you know, there's really no social life, and it's another level of fear for the younger people. And it's just an odd time. You know, you wish that there was more help, you know, from our government. We've just done so horribly in attacking this pandemic. But you know what? It looks like April, things won't come back probably until the late spring, early summer, unfortunately, where I think people feel safe again if they take the fucking vaccine. You know, who knows?
Yeah. It's so strange, you know, at a time when laughter is needed most, and then the comedy clubs are all closed down. But you know, that says you have a long history with Vegas, though. You sort of started out performing in Vegas and doing shows with legends like Frank Sinatra, and what is it about Vegas that has always been so incredible for show business?
You know, it's interesting because I wasn't there in the heyday. Obviously, I started in '86 when I started opening for different acts at the Desert Inn, and but even going back, you know, 30 some years. It was so different then, but it was just the place that where you knew the crowds were going to be great. They were coming for a good time. They were coming for the experience. They were going to see performers like, you know, they had never seen. And it was more like of a happening. I mean, even when in the 80s, someone would go to they'd go to a dinner show and they'd have a jacket on and they'd get all dude it up, you know, and it was like it was more of an event for everyday people that don't get to, you know, put on a tuxedo and go to a show or have an extravagant dinner while watching, you know, Sammy Davis or people they'd only known from TV. So it always had that incredible reputation.
That's
amazing. Over the years, it's become, you know, you got guys in the front row with flip-flops and shorts, and it's just a different time.
Yeah.
But what was really cool to see, even just the 3 weekends we were open and just sitting down and talking to the other comics, you know, it was how incredibly appreciative the audiences were these last couple weeks. It's like, you know, I was like, oh, the room is too big. The ceiling's 80 feet. It's, you know, I had every reason of like, this isn't like a club. And then you get out there and people, you know, they're masked and, you know, they're 6 feet apart and 25 feet. But there was an appreciation that anyone was coming out because you could see they were just, you know, so hungry for any kind of live entertainment. So that was an interesting thing for us to witness as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's no town like it. You've performed in Vegas and it's, you know, it's, I mean, at the club, people come from literally all over the world. It used to be a long time. They come from all over the country. But before the pandemic, you know, you had people from literally all different countries. And it just makes for some of the best comedy audiences.
Yeah, it's always interesting when you do crowd work and, you know, the guy in the front row is, you know, one guy's from Sweden and someone else is from, you know, Albuquerque.
Exactly.
Yeah, and you can really kind of, I think, have a lot of fun with the crowds there just because of the broad nature of different people that are there. So now you won Star Search when you were a kid, right? I'm sure this is one of the stories you've told a million times, but that must have just been, was it immediate that you knew you wanted to be a comedian before you went on Star Search or when you were a kid? Or
I started really, really early doing the open mic nights, you know, when I was like 18.
Yeah.
I grew up out here in Southern Cal, in the Valley, and I would just get up at any open mic nights, and you know, I looked 30, so I was able to get into most of the clubs, and you know, I just did a lot of, you know, open mic stuff, and I just knew it was something that was really always in me. And you know, in the beginning it was, you know, mostly very, you know, pedestrian type of stuff. It was, you know, I would do my impressions or bullshit like that. And then it just, you know, morphed into, an angry middle-aged privileged guy, you know, which I don't know if there's any need for that. But yeah, Star Search was really the beginning. It was the first year on Star Search. So, it got a lot of eyes on it. And to be honest, I was kind of the dark horse because I was going up against guys that really, you know, were a lot more seasoned. And I was kind of like the new guy, but you know, they only gave you 90 seconds on Star Search, and it was really never a great barometer for anyone's talent because your opening bit is technically your closing bit, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, there were some great people on Star Search, like, you know, going back to, I mean, from Ray to you know, Dennis Miller to a lot of guys, you know, certainly should have won, taking it all, but you know, you just never know. So I got lucky, and I just kept advancing, and it was I was 24 at the time, and it was a huge deal, you know, back in the day when there were very few channels even.
Yeah.
You know,
and Ed McMahon was hosting Star Search, of course, right? Is that sort of what led to you going on Johnny Carson as well on The Tonight Show?
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He was very, very helpful. I still had to audition for Jim McCauley, but a couple times, but Ed was able to, you know, set up that audition at least where I never would have gotten to be seen by Jim. And it was, you know, it was exciting, you know, to do one with the man. I mean,
yeah, you were one of the youngest comics ever to perform on stand up on The Tonight Show.
Yeah, I was. It wasn't the youngest. I was one of the youngest. I think Byron Allen and I think Freddie Prinze were definitely younger. I was almost like 24, almost my 24th birthday, just about a month away from it. And it was okay. It was an okay set. You know, it didn't knock the doors off. I didn't sit down my first time, but, it was really cool. Very surreal. You know, I was scared to death.
That was the famous thing that Carson, if he brought you over to the couch after, was there a moment where you were thinking, oh, he's going to bring me over to the couch, did that go through your mind, or are you just kind of trying to get through it?
I kept staring at him. He kept staring at me. I kept staring at him.
Yeah.
You know, and then someone drew the curtain.
Uh-huh.
So it was an ugly standoff.
What an incredible thing, though. I mean, they just to have been able to go on Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show at that age, too. I mean, it just must have been surreal.
It was. I'm, you know, as I just hit 60 and I look back at all of it, Tom, and I'm like, I've been very lucky. I've worked hard, but a lot of people work hard and work harder and, you know, they don't get the breaks and they have incredible talent. And it's, you know, I'm very, very grateful. I think it was a lot easier, you know, breaking in a stand-up in the 70s and 80s than it is today. And you would think today would be easier because there's 1,000 more outlets.
Yeah.
But I think everything gets muddied in all those outlets. You know, back in the day when you had a great act, you were going to be seen. It just mattered if it was on Merv Griffin or Mike Douglas or Carson or whatever. There was going to be a way you were going to get seen. Now, you know, there's so many talented people that's just finding a you know, everyone's putting themselves on YouTube, but it's tough to get a break on YouTube, you know?
Yeah, it's
and
kind
if
of...
You, if you kill... Yeah.
Kind of a double-edged thing in a way. It's just an opportunity for so many people, but then... Yeah, back in the day, you had to really, really want to do comedy. To you couldn't just pick out your phone and start sort of ranting about something you saw on Twitter. You actually had to get up, go to the club, get the stage time. Is that you think what the biggest change is with comedy now with social media, or is as the art form itself changed much as well?
Well, I think it's changed as far as, there are people that, you'll talk about like TikTok or Twitter, or they'll film themselves having a rant. And, because TV has become, I think TV's the stuff on television, I think the product most in many markets are better than ever. That being said, they believe so much of it is driven by social media, which I don't agree with, because when I see the best shows, I don't find them on Instagram or Twitter or anything, at least not shows that really ring to me, or at least not shows that'll get nominated for an Emmy or something. I find out through peers or friends or other people. But what they'll do, especially the production or the development companies, they'll find someone with 6 million views that has never worked on his craft, that's really not an actor, really not a stand-up. And they'll say, hey, you know what? We'll give them a pilot, and we'll see if we can get any of those 6 million viewers. And that has crashed just about every time, except for about maybe a couple instances, because, they put a person on a stage with a crew, and, they're not in their bathroom on their phone. And I think that they're seeing that more and more, that, because it's a business that, loves to whore out and try to grab as many eyes as they can. And many times they'll do it with people that, don't know their craft, that really it doesn't have legs. It's a video that went viral.
Yeah.
The Kardashian synopsis, as I always call it. There's only going to be one or two families like that, that become billionaires off a show that's really about nothing, that really is scripted. And it makes you say, well, and it's huge, and it's number one. So it makes you go, okay, well, maybe we can pull off, Three Sisters, and they've tried it many, many ways. And many, reality is gigantic in TV, obviously. It's the biggest moneymaker, hands down, reality television. So I think it tells a lot of people they can get a shot by doing a video, but we know that it's harder than that.
Yeah, it's interesting to imagine, what would people like back in the day have thought of what's going on today with television and how people are found? I mean, it used to be you'd go do stand up at the Comedy Store in Hollywood or the Improv, and maybe Johnny Carson's talent scout was in the audience, and that was how you got discovered,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. It's funny when I started out and. I had my first manager at the time, who was really, really a brilliant woman. And she was a low rent, manager. And I was a below rent new stand-up. I met her when I was 18. And, I always felt that I loved stand-up. But when I started acting, I thought that, well, maybe my chops are a little better in acting. I don't know. So I studied and then, there's nothing like live stand-up, as you know. There's just nothing like it. It's the greatest rush, at least for me. But as I was starting out, this manager knew, because we were based in, the heart of Hollywood. And she says, you don't want to go to the Improv. You don't want to go to the Comedy Store. And I'm like, why? She goes, well, you're 11 feet tall. And when you die, and you will, you are memorable. So she literally said, take your, because I was waitering at TGI Fridays for a few years as I was doing my open mic nights.
Right.
And she says, take your waitering money, go to El Paso, go to the Ice House in Pasadena, which is really where I started.
Yeah.
Go to Newport Beach at the Laugh Stop. And she says, stay out of the Improv and the Comedy Store, because, as every night, it was half industry.
Right.
and you know.
So you went and worked it out, figured it out in the at the ice house, and then when you were ready, you went in and hit the store.
That's it.
Wow. Yeah. Well, so I'm assuming that, you know, stand-up, of course, must really help in performing in front of a live studio audience on a sitcom on Everybody Loves Raymond. That must have really translated well. I mean, it did, obviously, but I've actually never performed on a sitcom in front of an audience like that, where you're performing and acting in front of an audience. Do you really feel the energy of that crowd, and do you connect with the crowd in that studio?
I think you do if you come from stand up. You know, it was you know, Ray and I came from stand up, obviously, before Raymond, and Peter was from film, and Doris was from everything, and Patty, you know, just came from another series. So we all brought, and we all felt it differently. You know, the key for me was go off the audience for your timing, but as a stand-up, don't play to them.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So I think that's the biggest challenge for a stand-up that gets a multi-camera series, is you have to be like, okay, they're there, your timing will be great, but remember, your timing just can't go off the audience because you're talking to someone at the same time.
Right? Yeah.
So if a joke, it's like if a one-liner you're doing on stage tanks, you can't approach it the way you do if you're doing your act, because you're going to get your next cue off your acting partner right in front of you. So it's really a kind of a zig and a zag. But Ray and I loved the stand-up. Loved the live audience. And of course, Ray would go out every night before we filmed, and he would do a couple minutes. And, you know, so few actors can do that in the sitcom if they're not stand-up people. So Ray just got him right where we needed him, and then, you know, it just flowed so much easier.
Yeah.
But that's why you'll see sitcoms, you know, you'll get some great comedic actors that, you know, multi-camera just isn't their thing. But, you know, as Phil Rosenthal always said, he's the one that created the show with Ray, and he's an amazing showrunner. And he said, you know, in multi-camera, you just need to look at it like a play. And when it works, it really is. It should feel like a play. It should be written like a play. I think that was always their intent as well.
What was the moment when you realized the show was a massive hit? What did that feel like? Not before, in the beginning, when you weren't sure, or later, sure, when, you know, it had been hit for a while. But just that moment when you realized, whoa, this is a massive hit.
It's when you go outside or go to the market, or that first time that, you know, and now my career is at, people think I'm Kramer when I go play. That's how I know the career is over. It's like, now it's like they've forgotten Ray, but a lot of people actually yell Kramer when I go into an airport or something, which is hysterical. Uh-huh. I'm not doing a bit, though it should be. But I think there's a creative time, you know, when it's successful. That doesn't always compute to your numbers. But we knew near the end of the first season that creatively, we were really firing on all cylinders. I mean, they throw you together, you don't know each other, and they go, okay, you're a family, go, you know?
Yeah.
And it takes time. But there was something about the, I don't know what it was. It's like, without sounding corny, you know, it's sometimes just lightning in a bottle. There's just a magic to it, you know? And it's a lot of it is how the different styles of a Peter or a Doris, you know, as the parents, you know, what is that chemistry going to be? Because you never know, you know, everyone auditions separately. Will that chemistry complement Ray and Patty? Is that going to be the dynamic the writers are going to want? So much of it is just, you know, creative luck. But early year two, you know, we really had an idea, you know, that the show, when they moved us, because we were on Friday nights, and we were getting killed in the ratings. And then they moved us Mondays after Cosby, before the raping. you know.
You almost have to mention that now, right? You can't really just sort of.
It just took off. It just took off year two, but you know, when people come up to you and they go, "My God, you're like my brother," or you know, "Doris is just like my mom. She won't leave us the fuck alone." Uh-huh. You know, when people come up to you and talk about that, as opposed to all that episode where you did, when they talk about like that, they really relate to it on that personal level. I think that's when you know you're hitting the target.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the show was based off of Ray's real family, but are you anything similar? There's a lot of similarities between you and Ray's brothers?
Well, you know, it's funny. I growing up, I had two older brothers. I was the youngest of three. And I was by far always felt like the mutant. You know, they had the same father. I had a different father growing up.
Okay. Yeah.
So they were regular sized humans. You know, I was the only one that was like circus sized.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I was like a head older. I was like a head taller than my oldest brother at like 12.
Yeah.
You know, and he had like 5 years on me.
Yeah.
You know, and he was like, well, you know, so I never, beyond the family thing, I was a guy who never really felt like I fit. I was never, you know, I was 6 feet at 12 and I couldn't make a layup and I wasn't a jock and I really wanted to be, you know, and I was horrible. And, you know, so I think I always felt like a less than type of pipe. So I think we all have shades of Robert in us.
Yeah.
But again, you know, it was the writing. It was, you know, when I read that pilot and they were not thinking of me at all. And it took a while to even get into audition. I knew the guy. I mean, I read the script and I told my manager at the time, I said, you know, I know this guy. And they were like, you know, you say that every time. I said, no, but I really know this character. And I went in and the writing, when it's written like that, you don't have to put much mustard on it. You know, it's just there.
Yeah.
So.
Wow, that's amazing. And the rest is history, right? That's just incredible. I mean,
the rest is history. And now I'm talking to a guy in a van.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's...
Which I love.
It's pretty beautiful out here. I don't know if you get out into the national parks much, but I've been going out to these... I was just up in the Gila National Forest looking at these cliff dwellings from the Mogollon Indians from... 1280 they built these and I'm making these videos and films up just as I'm traveling around looking at all. I was in a ghost town yesterday in Barstow, Texas, and just killing some time out here, Brad.
I gotta tell you, you know, I envy you because I have too much fear to be doing that, which you probably already gathered, but it sounds amazing. Now, if you had to suggest one national park the closest to California or northern or central Cali, I mean, I grew up here. I haven't even been to Yosemite.
Right, right.
Isn't that sad?
Yeah, you know, I haven't been to Yosemite yet either. My plan was to go there, but the fires kind of put a button on that this year. So that's next year where I'll go. And I want to go retrace the steps of Ansel Adams out there and all of his beautiful black and white photography.
Big fan of his.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm a friend of mine was his assistant in college.
Oh, wow.
Ansel Adams. And he's a photographer today, but he shoots like, you know, high school yearbook pictures. So he was never, but he was literally Ansel's assistant.
Wow.
And the stories are just remarkable. But I love photography, and I only really love black and white of any kind. And so that's exciting to go there. So
oh, cool.
If I had to get in the car, because I'm pulling my hair out with everything. If I get in the car and I'm going to drive a day.
I think
but
you
I
could
be out in the woods.
I mean,
where would I go?
Well, I mean, right now you could go up to, jot this down. This is a beautiful place. The Inyo National Forest, I-N-Y-O, the Inyo National Forest. It's just south of Yosemite. That's a beautiful place. And then there's also the Joshua Tree, which is desert, but beautiful desert, and also kind of trippy and peaceful.
If I go to Inyo, is there anywhere, Tom, where I could see trees? Where I could? I'm not a desert guy.
That would be Inyo. Yeah, that would be up there. You're just south of Yosemite, and maybe even actually into Yosemite, and that sort of Smokey the Bear kind of country. Yeah.
Okay. Now, can you get a little place to stay? Do you have to camp?
I'm sure you can. I'm sure you can. There must be some places you can probably get an Airbnb out there now, out at Big Bear or something like that.
Beautiful. And it isn't where the fires were, so it won't be messed up, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think they've kind of I think Inyo got kind of spared. Yeah. I'm not 100% sure, to be honest with you. But
you don't know many Jews, do you, Tom?
I know a fair amount, My good friend Rory Rosegarden, who is a manager.
Here's the thing about Rory.
Yeah.
Knowing Rory, you might as well know 40 Jews.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Because he's Jewish squared.
Okay,
that's what I love about Rory.
Okay, cool. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll
give him my best too.
I will, for sure.
I really, really like that man. He's such a quality guy, and it was great getting to know him.
Yeah, no, it's great. I was really happy that you were able to do this, and I'm so glad that he set this up.
Thank you for asking me.
Yeah, Brad, thanks so much, and best of luck with the comedy club, and thanks for calling in. And when stand up gets going again, I hope I can come down to Vegas and come do a spot and hang out with you at the club.
Oh God, would I be honored! We would be honored to have you there, Tom. You have an open invitation.
Oh wow, well I'll be there for sure. I love it. Thank you so much, Brad.
Yeah, we'll put you up in a nice room, no vans.
Nice. Perfect. Awesome. All right.
I would love it, sincerely.
Thank you,
and
Brad.
Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Brad. I appreciate it. Okay, have a great day, and we'll see you soon.
Okay, be safe. Bye-bye.
How cool is that? Brad Garrett. Thanks, Brad, for calling, and thanks, everybody, for listening. I feel so lucky and honored to be able to talk to the amazing and incredible people that I have grown up loving and respecting. Brad, of course, has been entertaining all of us for so many years, and it's just a real pleasure to have had him call into my van. And man, it's I gotta tell you, I'm in the middle of Texas right now. I was in a ghost town yesterday in Barstow, Texas. I'm right now going to edit that video and upload it to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/TomGreen. I want you guys to subscribe here to the Tom Green Interview Podcast, and then watch the visuals on Instagram and on YouTube, because I think they all go together. The podcast goes together with the visuals. I like to think that I'm creating something here for all of us to enjoy that is kind of a fun little journey that we get to go on together. And I'm really thinking about all of you every day when I'm traveling with Charlie and my cameras, my drone, and getting these shots and this footage, and of course, recording these podcasts right here in the van. So I'm actually going to open up the van door now. Charlie's been sitting here reasonably quietly. Let me just make sure that the alarm doesn't go off. And there you go. It's getting a little cold out, actually. Heading a little bit further north. But it's getting a little bit cold out. And we're not in the most remote of areas right now. We're pretty close to a road. Probably hear some cars going by. But we are, essentially in a nice farming area here. And it's quite beautiful. But I'm heading off into much more remote, much more deep unknown places tomorrow, actually. I just wanted to pull over here and do the podcast here because I have cell service, you see, and that's how Brad was able to call in and my mom was able to call in. on the cellular telephone. But a lot of the places that I've been going, there's been no cell service, and it's been really quite quite incredible, some of the things that I've gotten to see and do. So thanks for coming along on this ride with me and Charlie, and we'll see you next week on the Tom Green Interview. Be safe, everyone.